Sunday of Advent. It's the very height of the season of apocalyptic expectation for the first coming of Jesus and for the second. Probably this morning still clinging to your clothes like cat fur, like the remnants of the darkest night of the year, having just passed the bleak midwinter of the solstice. We've lit four candles against the dark. Our nerves are on edge. And then the scriptures that we heard throw us right into the pages of the norm. Right? Into a world of politicians who feign piety and of procreation and family trees. Heartbreak and ambiguity, difficult decisions, baby names, divorce. And God. All here. We catch up first with King Ahaz in the 8th century BC, somewhere in the middle there. And he's by the end of the conduit near the upper pool on the highway on the way to the Fuller's Field, it says at the beginning of Isaiah before our reading picks up. In other words, he is scoping out the aqueducts of the city of Jerusalem. He's checking out their precarious and vulnerable water supply because he has heard a rumor that two of Israel's neighbors are amassing armies, and he doesn't know what they're about. He can feel the fabric of national security unraveling in his own hands. And so he is there, his hands and his eyebrows knit in worry, worried about the future, wondering what he can do, planning, making a list of the powerful nations around Israel, like Assyria, that he could maybe approach, wondering what he could offer them in quid pro quo for some aid. And into that place of worry steps the prophet Isaiah, sent there to say to Ahaz, "Do not be afraid. This won't end the way you think it will. If you do not stand in trust, you will not stand at all." And Ahaz says nothing. Apparently brushes it off. Maybe his eyes flick back to the shadows that are creeping around him in the kingdom of Israel in the south. And so Isaiah pipes up again and says, "We'll ask for a sign, man. Anything you want." I think this is the only time in scripture anyone gets a blank check like this from God. What does Ahaz say in return? "Oh, I couldn't possibly. He's real Canadian, right?" But not actually out of piety. Ahaz is nervous to be called out from his place of worry, where he's beginning to make plans for how to manage the situation, and to be drawn out into this place where he might be forced to trust the prophet's promise. Seems like too much, and so he withdraws. But God presses in through Isaiah and says, in what might be the best burn in the whole Bible, is it too little a thing that you have to weary everyone else, that you have to weary me too, Ahaz? Tell you what, I'll give you a sign of my own choosing. There's a young woman. She's going to give birth to a son. She's going to call that son Emmanuel, Hebrew, Im, with, Ani, us, El, God, whose name means God is with us. And before that kid is old enough to make decisions for himself, 2 or 3, he will eat honey and curds. That is, he will eat the food of peace and plenty. What the prophet seems to be saying is that visible to Ahaz himself would be a child born, maybe even in the royal household. And that child's own first few years of growing up will mark the dispelling of these shadows that have crept in from the side. So don't do something stupid trying to seize the reins and turn here into somewhere else. If you read on past the passage in Isaiah, or you follow Ahaz over into the book of Kings, what you discover is that Ahaz refuses the sign that's given to him as something to hold on to. And actually instead chooses to send word up to Assyria and their emerging empire, and that it's only a matter of time before they swoop in and scatter the northern tribes of Israel. Clear the way for Babylon to come and do the same thing in the south. But Ahaz has as much as put an axe in the hands of the nations to chop down the house of David, this tree of Jesse. Before long, will be cut down to its bare stump. Meanwhile, this sign hangs there, announcing that somehow God is with Israel. The clock moves forward and the curtain pulls back again on another scene. We are 700 and some years later. The tree of the house of Jesse, the royal family tree of Israel, has been cut down to a stump, and we meet a man who is one of the rings left on. The stump has not grown. Israel has no king in the Davidic line. That's what happens to a tree when it's under shadow and shadow and shadow and never sees any light. And Israel has been under shadow for centuries. Assyria, Babylon, Persia, Greece, Rome. We catch up with a man named Joseph. We all know something about him. And we find Joseph about to sleep on a difficult decision. He had had his future planned out. This woman from the village was engaged to. And then he finds out, we're not told how, firsthand, maybe, probably secondhand, maybe through the rumor, that that girl, Mary, is pregnant. And is left to draw his own conclusions. He can feel the fabric of his own future unraveling in his hands. So he makes the difficult decision to pull the ripcord on the thing and get out while he can and cut his losses. He tries to be quiet about it. And he goes to sleep, having made the decision. There into the place of worry steps God's messenger again, this time an angel, this time in a dream, but with the same words. Do not be afraid. Do not be afraid to take Mary as your wife. It's not what you think. It's something way more absurd. Angel has the gall to tell Joseph that the same God whose spirit hovered over the formless void in the beginning and brought something out of nothing has hovered over Mary to bring something out of nothing. Something that is a part of regular human genealogy, and yet not. And that the son that is in her will be called Jesus, but he will as good as have a second name, a very old name. And the angel recalls this text from the book of Isaiah. The young woman, the virgin, will be with child. She will bear a son, and you shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. And the angel doesn't just say that this is going to happen in parallel. He says that what will happen in Joseph's own sight will fill those words to the full and to overflow. This son had a name that meant God is with us. suspend yourself in that moment just for a moment, like the poet W.H. Auden did in his long Advent and Christmas poem called For the Time Being, which if you haven't read, is great Advent reading. It's not too late. When Auden picks up the story of Joseph, he calls the whole scene the temptation of Joseph. How easy it would be for Joseph to brush the dream off. It's a dream, after all. Is this really what he's supposed to gamble his future on? Can he really believe an angel that speaks in the night? Can't he plead the Scrooge excuse, right? There's more of gravy than of the grave about you, Ebenezer Scrooge says. Can he chalk this up to a bad meal? Can he afford to be drawn out to take this angel seriously, to put his trust that God has come to claim Joseph's life in a way that will make sure he's the permanent object of the reward, in a way that will secure the fact that he will become a refugee in a short while on the run from another political leader who's feigning piety, hiding murderous intentions. But Joseph will fade into obscurity, into the shadows behind Mary and Jesus. We don't even know when he died. Joseph woke. And he did as the angel commanded. He took this tangible sign, this tangible human being, and the tangible human being growing in him. And he wed himself to all of that, choosing it as his here rather than going somewhere else. I think today is the first time that I've told this story in public, but there was just one time I thought I heard the voice of God. I know that's going to sound crazy. I was 21. I was living in Montreal for the summer. The girl that I was dating was working as a lifeguard at the pool, and I was working as a pool boy, in-ground pool repair guy. It was a hot, muggy July day. I'd gotten off work, and my head, as it often was in those days, and if I'm honest, hasn't been since, was filled with the future and the uncertainty and the restless longing to be somewhere other than I was, the sense that I was stuck. What was I going to do next year after I graduated with my bachelor's degree? Was I going to carry this relationship further? What happened if the relationship went wrong? Would I have what it took? And I was consumed with all of that as I pulled just down the street from the pool that my girlfriend worked at, parked the car, and sat there off somewhere else, eventually stewing myself to this point when I know that not only wanted to be somewhere else, I wanted to be someone else. Do you know what I mean? It's hard to talk about these things. I would like to have traded places with someone. And while I was spinning all of that out, clear as day, just behind my head, as if from the back seat, I love you, calling me like that. Scared the crap out of me. I whirled around, thinking that I'd place that belongs when I actually figure myself out. Once I'm actually not riddled with all of this stuff. Once my life is actually something that I actually want. And I forgot about that day until many years later, when my hopes had unraveled, and my life had ground to a halt, and I'd spent time reading the autobiography, The Confessions of St. Augustine, who says at one point, looking back, "Lord, you were with me back then. I wasn't with you. Lord, you were with me. I wasn't with you." Because God comes to be here with us. Here in the world as we know it. The world that's full of politicians who feign piety, full of family trees and trouble with procreation and heartbreak and the rumor mill and divorce and baby names, full of frustration, hopes that are dashed, and disappointment and sudden joy. This is the world that God comes to, and to all of our healers to be with us. Before Advent, hope takes us somewhere. It's first about here, and the proclamation, the promise, Emmanuel, that God has come to be with us here, even if you'd rather be somewhere else. This is the place that God wants to be with you. And that God has come to take our lives and all of the particularities and difficulties and joys and gather them into his own self. And in a short time, we will watch, if we keep at this thing Sunday by Sunday, we will watch Mary's boy come out into the light and then fade into the obscurity of years that apparently so boring no one wanted to talk about. And when he comes out into public, he's going to be divisive. And he's going to have friends, but half of them are going to be twits who turn their back on him. And he's going to know intimately being ragged, exhausted, and being called onward, being loved and being hated, having hopes probably to have a family, only to see that